Okay, everyone, good afternoon. Today is August 3rd, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues of Houston, Texas, for our weekly lunch and learn, studying Parshat HaShavua. We've had quite a long break, but we're back now, and this week is Parshat Matot Maaseh. We are going to look at the second of the two Parshiot, Parshat Maaseh, which you can find on page 362 in the JPS Tanakh, who's a famous, well, I don't know if it's famous, but often asked question that many commentaries deal with at the beginning of this week's Parsha. And what's interesting is to note is the various answers that they give to the same, very same question. So let's start on page 362, and just everyone take a quick perusal on their own of chapter 33, starting with verse 1 on the bottom of 362, all the way to chapter, same chapter, verse 37 on 364.
That's what you had the map.
That yeah, 362 to 364. Yeah. And just just quickly glance through those psukim, if you don't mind. And as you're glancing through those psukim, a question or two may come to your mind. See if we can figure out what's bothering everybody else. Don't scream it out. Give everyone else a chance to think about it. My educational professors would be very proud of me that I just warned everyone not to do that.
There you go.
Give everyone a chance.
What comes to my mind?
Hold on 1 second, Shula. Hold on. I want to give everyone a chance. If I was really doing this the right way, I would ask everyone to write the question down on a piece of paper next where they sit, and I would come around and look at it. So literally everyone would have a chance to answer the question without being biased by anybody else.
What was in my torch?
Okay, anyone want to give it a shot? Shula, did you want to offer something?
Nothing spectacular, just that they don't tell us what happened at each station. It's just like going from here to there, from there to there.
Okay, good. What you're on the right track.
I want the story.
Good, you're on the right track.
Then they say that they came to the Sea of Reeds and then they set out for the Sea of Reeds. So they don't isn't that when they parted the Sea of Reeds?
Yeah. Okay. Good. So they've seen some detail is definitely missing in this story. Good. Okay. Excellent.
Well, it's not just details. They seem to travel a long time before they cross the sea, rather than crossing the sea right away.
A lot of different stops. Okay.
They set out from Eitam.
But all of your questions are based on something else. How do you know that something else happened at the Sea of Reeds?
Well, that's when
it's not here.
How do you know?
From previous.
You read it already. Yeah. So what's the question?
Why don't they mention it?
No, we meant. Why would they mention it here if they mentioned it already?
Why are they crossing back?
They're not crossing back. No. This is a recapitulation. It's a more fundamental question. Mm-hmm. You just said it without saying it. You know this already. Right. Why is it here again?
Reinforced.
All these places
I'm not asking you for an answer. I'm saying that's the question.
I guess it's
right? If you know, if the fact that you could say, well, hold on a second, all the details of all the things that happened that these stops are missing, that means you already know that these stops happened.
Right.
Which means they were already listed somewhere else in the Torah.
So if
they were already listed else somewhere else in the Torah, why are they listed again?
To remind you.
There's some minor differences, but by and large, this is stuff that has been already covered in the Torah.
Well, it's okay.
It's a reminder.
End of the book, it's finished. So they have a review of all this.
Why?
That we should get an idea really how long it was.
Okay, so now we're already getting to answers. But but that's the question. So we have to see what the answers are. But I think it's a fair question.
Yeah.
As to why. Separate question as to why are some of the details different. We're not going to get into all of that. But why are all these things listed? And you'll see that there are a number of very interesting answers. In fact, this question so bothered the Rambam that he dedicated an entire chapter of the Mor Nevuchim to just this question. The Mor Nevuchim is the Rambam's philosophical work, where he spends a lot of time figuring out things in the Torah and trying to understand why things are listed the way they're listed. And there's a whole chapter, part 3, chapter 50 in the Mor Nevuchim, deals just with this question. Well, we'll read a few tidbits from this on page 1, on the bottom left of the source sheet.
This is all from the Rambam.
Not the whole source sheet, but what we're going to read now is on the Rambam. Okay. There are in the law, the Torah, portions which include deep wisdom, but have been misunderstood by many persons. They require, therefore, an explanation. So which parts of the Torah is the Rambam suggesting have been misunderstood? The answer is, I mean the narratives contained in the law, which many consider as being of no use whatever. For example, the list of the various families descended from Noah, with their names and their territories, the sons of Seir, the Chorit, the kings that reigned in Edom, and the like. There is a saying of our sages that the wicked king Menashe frequently held disgraceful meetings for the sole purpose of criticizing such passages of the law. Now, to your point, Shula, it's true that reading this list this way gives us a sense of the length of their journey, but the truth is, with not that much effort, I could have done that on my own. I could have gone back to Sefer Shemot and read and made my own list, right? But the truth is, your answer is very close to the Rambam's answer, so we'll get to that in a second. But this is what the Rambam is saying. You have all these things in the Torah which people seem to indicate have no purpose, and this is one of them. He says, right, that this long list of encampments and travel, the travel log, right, of Bnei Yisrael, is one of those things. I'll show you. Well, before I get to that, look on the top of the right column, still on page 1, the top of the right column, second paragraph. The Rambam lays down his top of the right column on page 1. Okay, top of the right, second paragraph, where it says every narrative, right? So the Rambam lays down his principle, right? His fundamental principle of how to interpret these narrative passage. Every narrative in the law serves a certain purpose in connection with religious teaching. It either helps to establish a principle of faith, or to regulate our actions, and to prevent wrong and injustice among men, and I will show this in each case. So whenever you have a narrative in the Torah which seems to not be necessary, you could see if you could figure out which of these three purposes of the Rambam it serves to fulfill. Now, it could be more than one, but it has to be at least one, right? To establish a principle of faith, to regulate our actions, and to prevent wrong and injustice among men. For every narrative in the Torah. We're not talking about necessarily the halachic passages of the Torah. The halachic passages of the Torah are different. These are the narratives of the Torah.
Stories.
Okay. So what are some of them? For example, we could go to the second to last paragraph. Stay where you are. Second to last paragraph on the right side of the page, which is the narration of the war among the nine kings. Second to bottom paragraph on that same page. The narration of the war among the nine kings shows how, by means of a miracle, Abraham, with a few undisciplined men, defeated four mighty kings. It illustrates at the same time how Abraham sympathized with his relative, who had been brought up in the same faith, and how he exposed himself to the dangers of warfare in order to save him. We further learn from this narrative how contented and satisfied Abraham was, thinking little of his property and very much of good deeds. He said, I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet. Okay? You could take or leave Rambam's interpretation, but from his perspective, even that strange or seemingly unnecessary narrative, which does not add any law, does not tell us anything about the formation of the Jewish people, why it was necessary to put that in the Torah, and the Rambam offers his explanation. So now, what does he say about our narrative? So now, you could look where he talks about our narrative on the bottom of the second page. We're on the left side of the second page, that last large paragraph. It is also necessary to note the following observations. Everyone see that? Anyone not have it? Okay, so here the Rambam begins to answer what our long list of travel stops, what's it for? So also he tries to lay down a general principle here. It is also necessary to note the following observations. The view we take of things described by others is different from the view we take of things seen by us as eyewitness. That I think most of us would agree with. For that which we see contains many details which are essential and must be fully described. The reader of the description believes that it contains superfluous matter or useless repetition. But if he had witnessed the event of which he reads, he would see the necessity of every part of the description. When we therefore notice narratives in the Torah which are in no connection with any of the commandments, we are inclined to think they are entirely superfluous or too lengthy or contain repetitions. But this is only because we do not see the particular incidents which make those narratives noteworthy. And then it gets to our piece. Of this kind is the enumeration of the stations of the Israelites in the wilderness. At first sight, it appears to be entirely useless. But in order to obviate such a notion, Scripture says, and Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord. It was indeed most necessary that these should be written. For miracles are only convincing to those who witness them, whilst coming generations who know them only from the account given by others may consider them as untrue. But miracles cannot continue to last for all generations. It is even inconceivable. Now the greatest of the miracles, this is really interesting, the greatest of the miracles described by the law is the stay of the Israelites in the wilderness for 40 years with a daily supply of manna, right? When we think of the big miracles, we normally think of the splitting of the sea and of the 10 plagues, right? But the biggest miracle, and that's because it lasted for 40 years, right, was that God kept the Jewish people alive in the desert. The wilderness, as described in Scripture, consists of places wherein fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there is no water, places remote from cultivated land, etc. It goes on and on and on. Top of the next page. All these miracles were wonderful, public, and witnessed by the people. But God knew that in the future, people might doubt the correctness of the account of these miracles in the same manner as they doubt the accuracy of other narratives. They might think that the Israelites stayed in the wilderness in a place not far from inhabited land where it was possible for man to live. So there you have it. We have the list. So people could go back and say, oh, this is where the Jews were? How is it possible they survived here? There was no neighboring village for them to go get food. There's no oasis here. There's no well here. It must have been that God sustained them in the desert. This that it was like those deserts in which Arabs live at present, or they dwelt in such places in which they could plow, sow, and reap, or live on some vegetable that was growing there, or that manna came always down in those places as an ordinary natural product. In order to remove all these doubts and to firmly establish the accuracy of the account of these miracles, Scripture enumerates all the stations so that coming generations may see them. So on one level, Shula, you really nailed it, right? So that everyone could see exactly where they were. Why is it important to see where they were? So they could recognize the miraculous nature of how they live. But there is one, I think, fundamental question or problem with Rambam's interpretation. What do you want to say, Dov?
He's also putting forth a philosophical position in which he says there's more to the Torah than just giving them some mitzvot.
Correct.
Right. So the first question he asks is, why do this if it's only for the mitzvot?
Right.
So in a way, he's telling people the Torah is not just for the mitzvot, which some people have that
position. Right. It's all those things. Principles of faith, right. Regulate our actions, exactly. To prevent wrong and injustice from our.
Correct.
Absolutely. Yeah, he says that in more than one place.
Right.
100%.
Because I know that there are all kinds of questions. Well,
right.
Why do we hear,
by the way,
the Torah before the
this is the first question that Rashi asks,
right,
in the Torah.
Exactly.
Why do we start with the Genesis narrative? Let's just skip to the first mitzvah of the Torah of Rosh Chodesh.
Right.
And the answer, one of the answers, because no, it's not only it's a book of beliefs.
It's also a history.
There's a fundamental question that we can still ask on the Rambam. It's the same question I asked on Shula. I was only being difficult. Which is, I have this list. I have to put it together myself, but I have it.
Right.
So, I mean, if according to the Rambam, the purpose is to remind everyone the great miracles, it's all in the Torah. So I guess maybe you already, I mean, it's all in the Torah before this. As the narrative is unfolding itself. So it could be that it's much more powerful when you read it this way.
Exactly.
Right? It really makes a great impression
he says that the
on end, you.
Why don't you move all these doubts and put instead of the accuracy in it, which enumerates all the stations.
Right.
Okay, here.
It really gives you... There are other answers. This is the Rambam's answer. But I really want to introduce you to this paragraph, this whole chapter of the Rambam. And I actually photocopied the whole thing. You can read it. It's not that long. It's less than two pages. Because the Rambam uses this entire chapter to answer why various other seemingly unnecessary narratives are included in the Torah. Okay, that's the Rambam's answer. Now I want to show you something really neat that I saw in Rashi. I've learned this Rashi a million times. And only this morning it occurred to me that there's a big problem with this Rashi. Turn to page 4. Rashi asks the same question. The Rashi is right here. It's under the line. Right where it says Rashi in Hebrew and in English? Right under the line. This is Rashi's question. Lama nichtavu hamasaot halalu? Why were these stages written? So by the way, you know we're already in good company. If the Rambam and Rashi ask the question, it's not a klutz kasha, as they say. Right? It's not a stupid question. Okay? So this is Rashi's answer. Lohodia chasadav shel makom. To make known the kinds of acts, make known the kind acts of the omnipresent, that although he decreed against them to make them move about and to cause them to wander in the wilderness, you should not say that they were wandering and moving about from stage to stage all 40 years. But this is not the Rashi you have a problem with. It's Rashi. Rashi offers two answers to the question. We'll learn this one first. This is neat. Think about this, right? If you read this list, it sounds like they were moving all the time, like every month. Go and go, right? Listen to this. Let's follow the math. We shouldn't think they were moving around for 40 years so much. For there are mentioned here only 42 stages. So that's already, if you want to just average it out, it sounds like they were about in each place for a little less than a year. But it gets better. So even if you leave it at that, it's not that they're getting up every month or week, right? Once a year, okay? But listen to this. Deduct from them 14, all of which were during the first year before the decree, as Dov noticed right away. But in the very beginning, there are lots of steps. So you have 14 at the very beginning. From the time that they journeyed from Ramses until they came to Ritmah, from whence the spies were sent forth, right? Because presumably, much of this is only a result of the Chet HaMeraglim, of the sin of the spies. So that whole 40-year period has to be looked at as what happened before the sin of the spies and what happened after the sin of the spies. Before the sin of the spies, they were in 14 different spots that in 1 year. That's a lot. Okay? Then, as it said, and afterward the people journeyed from Chatzerot, etc., etc. And here it states, and they journeyed from Chatzerot and pitched in Ritmah. Hence you learn that it is in the wilderness of Paran. Deduct also from their 8 stages, which were after the death of Aaron, from Mount Hor, until Arvot Moab, the plains of Moab, during the 40th year. So you had 8 in the first year. I'm sorry, you had 14 in the first year and 8 in the last year. So how many does that leave you? Okay. The above, right? So they have, during the 40th year, constantly all 38 years, they journeyed only 20 stages. So that's that's almost 2 years in each spot. So the first year was very busy, and the last year was very busy. But for 38 years, they were just sort of...
They were dying
hanging out.
They were dying out, but they weren't going, meaning it wasn't... as hard as it could be to move from desert in the desert, it wasn't that they were expected to uproot their camp so often, which would have made it even harder. That's why, according to Rashi, we have this list. Now it makes sense also why we have a list like this, because then you could do the math much easier.
You mean to say that they could have made, could be much
older? Sure. You look at a map. How long do you think it would take you to walk from Mitzrayim to Israel? If you go straight. Yes, right. They didn't go straight.
They walked in the first year, right there, and then with the Miraglim, the first year they got.
How long did it take Israel to get to, you know, a couple miles from Cairo in the Yom Kippur War? Not so far. They had tanks,
they
but still.
On the way.
They had tanks too. That helped, but still, right? So, the Chet HaEgel is the thing that extended. They were going all over the place.
Is that because of the Chet HaEgel and Chet HaMeraglim?
Chet HaMeraglim, not Chet HaEgel. Chet HaMeraglim. According to Rashi, we have the list to show us that the trip wasn't as bad as it sounds. Okay. Right. Yes, yes.
You're confused. Before the spies, did that count?
It was 40 years total.
Funded before the spying?
Yes. Okay. Correct. 40 years total. Good question.
I always thought it started at the time of the spying.
Good question. No. They got a 1 year. They got a 1 year. I guess they got off easy. 1 year for good behavior.
So still, why did they cram on the first year and the last year, and why it was slow?
Oh, good question. Not sure. Why there were so many stops.
No, seriously.
No, that's not the question. Is why there were so many stops in the first year? That's a good question. I'm not sure. Excellent question.
Caterer.
What's that?
Caterer.
What do you mean?
Caterer.
The caterer. Okay. But now let's look at this next Rashi. V'rabbi Tanchuma Darash Bo Drasha Acheret. We're on page 4, bottom of the left side of Rashi. Tanchuma is an early midrash. He offered another interpretation. Mashal lemelech sheya beno choleh. This could be likened to a king whose son was sick. Volicho lemakom rachok, and the king took him from a distant place. Continue on the bottom of the next page, bottom of page 5, under the line, to cure him. When they were returning, the father began to enumerate all the stages, saying to him, here we slept, here we caught a cold, here your head ached. So, what does that mean? What does this mean? What's the message of Rabbi Tanchuma's, according to Rabbi Tanchuma, the reason why we have this list is to recall it to Bnei Yisrael, and for what purpose?
Well, most of the people who are alive now, they didn't do it. Most of the people who actually did this are dead.
Right.
So he's telling the next generation, he's recounting for the next generation what happened.
Who did what?
Moshe is talking to them just before they're going into Israel.
Right.
So most of the people who experienced this journey have died.
Right. So what's the right? So we understand why. Right. But how does Rabbi Tanchuma's, what is Rabbi Tanchuma is explaining? You can compare this list to a father telling a child, oh, here you caught a cold, here you had a headache. What's the analogy?
Now you're all better.
What's the analogy?
Well, this is what we went through to get you.
This is what we went through.
To get you to.
And how'd you get through this?
A lot of effort?
How'd you get through this?
God
helped you. God helped you. Same thing the father would say. Here you had a headache, so I gave you a cold compress. Here you caught a cold, so I took care of you. Right? So that's the way one of the commentaries reads this Rashi. Right? One of the commentaries reads this Rashi to be saying, just before the Jews are about to get into Eretz Israel, along the lines of what Dov said, you have a new generation of people who didn't experience it, or all of it, and they say, just want to remind you before you get in how good I was to you. I took care of you in all these places. There was no food. There was no water. It was hot at day, so I gave you a cloud to protect you from the sun. It was cold and dark at night, so I gave you a pillar of fire to warm you and show you where to go. I took care of you this whole way.
Big deal, but you didn't have to drive us so long.
Fair point. No, I did have to drag. No, that's not true. I did. I did have to drag you so long.
Just to show you?
No. No. I dragged you so long because I was punishing your ancestors for what they did. But at the same time, I kept you alive. Okay? That's the. That's all.
But if he wanted them dead, why did he?
Where they're getting now, it was very hard to get to the land of Israel. And now, what?
Well, that's sort of more of what the Rambam says. But here, it's different. Here, it's a different focus. Here, it's look how much love and affection I showered on you all those years.
Waiting for you to die.
Now. No, these are people who are alive.
I know.
This is
the
speech he's giving to people who are getting in, not waiting for you to die. You're getting in.
I know you're getting in, but all this he was doing all
along. Yeah, people die.
I know people.
People die.
But people would have died quicker if they didn't have water and food.
I don't understand what that has to do with this.
Then you wouldn't have.
Okay. So. So.
The point.
Let's try to stay focused. The point is that the journey had to take 40 years because the people did not merit to get to the land of Israel. So they were dying off a natural death. Instead of God just killing them all at once, they died off a natural death over the course of 40 years. And at the same time, God is saying to them, all of you who are making it in, you're only making it in because of the love I showered on you. Now, that's where Rashi stops the Midrash. But the problem is, that's not the end of the Midrash. Now, I pointed out that one of the commentaries on Rashi, Rashi is a commentary on the Torah, and there are commentaries on Rashi, they're called super commentaries. They say Rashi's point is to highlight God's goodness. But now, look at the next page, and here you have the whole Midrash on page 6. Read the Midrash. Number 3, I underlined the part that Rashi leaves out.
Uh-huh.
What's the real point of the Midrash?
When they really
What's the real point of the Midrash?
Where they didn't
to tell people, listen, don't tick me off again.
The real point of the Midrash is not, right, as Rashi's commentary says, to tell Bnei Israel how much God loved them. It's to remind them how terrible they were. So the headache wasn't a lack of food. The headache was the golden calf. And catching a cold wasn't a lack of water. Catching a cold was a complaint about this and a complaint about that. Right? So it's so interesting. Rashi uses a part of a Midrash to make a point that he wants to make, which is not the point that the author of the Midrash wanted to make to begin with. Right? Which, if you experts in Rashi say Rashi did this. Rashi would often take a fragment of a Midrash to make the point he wants to make, even though the Midrash is longer. So there are two, Rashi's point is beautiful, but that's not what the Midrash wanted to say. So according to Rashi, the reason why we have the list is to be inspired to remind ourselves how good God was to us. But according to the author of the Midrash, the reason we have a list is to remind ourselves how lousy we were. And despite that, despite how lousy we were, God kept. It's like the ultimate guilt trip. Right? This list, according to the Midrash, is a huge guilt trip.
Now you proved it. God is a figure.
Is a Jewish mother.
Absolutely.
Right. I just found that interesting. It didn't occur to me. I've learned this Rashi so many times to go back to the original Midrash to see it, and then I see, hey, wait a second. Now, there's another way that you could read this Rashi. It could be that Rashi assumes that you know the Midrash, right? You have to remember who Rashi was talking to. Rashi was writing in his generation, not for us. He was writing for a generation of people who knew Midrash. So not necessarily scholars, but people who knew Midrash, right? So it could be that Rashi wrote the beginning and we're supposed to know what he meant, but it's unclear. I think the scholars on Rashi will debate what exactly this point was. Okay, so far we have the Rambam, that the list is to remind us of all the miracles that were done. 2, we have a list to remind us of all the grace that God showered on us while we were traveling in the desert. And 3, we have a list to remind us of how terrible we were in the desert. And despite that, God kept us alive. Now we come to the fourth and final interpretation that I found in this. Okay? I actually found it in two places. On page 7. We'll see it a little bit in Hebrew, and then we'll see it more spelled out in the English essay. So this is from the commentary Dat Mikra, which we've used before. And in summing up, in introducing this section, he writes as follows. B'midah misuyemet, where the arrow is on page 7. B'midah misuyemet nitan lahashvot et harishima hamisakemet shebeparshatenu l'rishimat shloshim ve'chad hamilachim sheika Yoshuv ne Yisrael. There's a similarity between this list and the list that you find in the book of Joshua about the kings that he defeated. Let's look at the book of Joshua, chapter 12, starting with verse 9. I will tell you the page 1 second. Page 483. And the following are the local kings who Joshua and the Israelites defeated on the west side of the Jordan, from Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon to Mount Halak, etc. Page 483.
A lot of kings.
Right? Okay, these are the kings he had to destroy, right? List. Okay? Now. Okay, let's go now. Go back into this text. Okay. Alzo Amru Shehim Bichinat Surata Shirat Nitzachon. What is this list in Joshua? It's a victory song. Right? These are all the kings that we destroyed, that we beat, okay. Right? Shirat Nitzachon. No, that's different. Shekol echad milamin aleph charuzeh hapoteach b'melech u'misayim be'echad milim hamishamshot mein pizmon chozer. Right? There's a certain rhythm of the song, right? That just like when we there's a rhythm of this song, which is right. Melech Yericho echad. Melech ha'ay asher mitzad beit el echad. Melech Yerushalayim Echad, Melech Hebron Echad, right? There are repeated words in this list, just like there are repeated words in our list. What are the repeated words in our list? Vayisu Vayachanu. Vayisu Vayachanu. And they went, they traveled, and they camped. And they traveled, and they camped. Right? There's a similar meter or beat, right, that you have when you have one word at the beginning, the same word, and one word at the end. So, okay, Shebahen Matchil Mistayim Kol Pasuk B'Chelkayim Tzai. Right, we have Vayachanu, Vayisu Vayachanu begins and ends each of the pieces of the itinerary. Right. So it could be that what he's saying. Now, let's hold off. Let's see it more explicitly in this article on page 8. There's as with all non-traditional interpretations of the Bible. Right, some argue that this list, which we find in the beginning of Maaseh, it was written by different authors, and it was just thrown together. Okay, that's the non-traditional view of how the whole Torah was written. If you've been coming to the Shiurim on Shabbat afternoon, we've been talking about biblical criticism. Right, that's one approach. But here, that's a non-traditional approach. Here, he offers something interesting. Recently, page 8. G.I. Davies, I don't know who this is, a Bible scholar, has suggested a new approach, meaning what is this list? Is it, meaning, does it have integrity? Is it a single list written by one author? Or is it a conglomerate written by multiple authors? If it's a single list written by one author, we have lots of questions. One is, why are some of the details different from other parts of the Torah? But he wants to argue the following. Recently, G.I. Davis has suggested a new approach based on comparative literary grounds. This is why you have to study other literature from the time of the Bible. He notes that the style of the literary train, they set out from A and encamped at B, they set out from B and encamped at C, is also exemplified in the records of military campaigns in the ancient Near East. Thus, the letter of Shamshi Adad I of Assyria, found in the Mari archive, describes the following transport. From Shubat Enil to Tila, from Tila to Ashihim, from Ashihim to Iyati, etc., etc. Here, just as in Numbers 23, which is our Parsha, the stations are repeated. The correspondence, however, is not exact since the Mari account is verbalist. Okay, turn the page. Let's go to page 9. Okay, go to page 9. One can conclude from this list of stations in Numbers 33 is part of a widely attested itinerary genre. In particular, it exhibits the same form and style as the 9th century campaign records of the Assyrian monarchs. It repeats the name of the campsites and adds pertinent information regarding military exploits, the availability of water and provisions, which we have in this, and the crossing of rivers, which we have in this, but does not indicate dates or distance covered. Israel's wilderness trek, also a military campaign, was therefore written down according to the prevailing ancient Near Eastern style of recounting itineraries of military campaigns. That's a fascinating approach, right? This is also a conquest travel. Now, they didn't have battles in all the places, but they did have battles in some of the places. And what's the ultimate purpose of this trip?
To get to Israel.
Where they are going to do what?
Battle.
Battle all these kings that we just read about in Joshua so that they could ultimately inherit and take over Eretz Israel. So he's arguing that the list makes perfect sense. If you look at it in a vacuum, we don't understand. But if you look at it in the way that ancient Near Eastern records were written, it makes perfect sense that you have a list like this, especially if you want to look at this as a military, as a list which is enumerating a military campaign. So from a literary perspective, they want to argue, this guy G.I. Davis and others wants to argue that it makes perfect sense. Now, it was written by God in a traditional view and not by people. Okay, but it was written by God in the style of what was common back in the ancient Near East.
So those two lists, the same thing. One is they're counting the kings and one they're counting the...
No, this list that we read in Joshua
it's not
the same. These are the list of people that Joshua defeated once they got to Eretz Israel. But the point is, it's reminiscent that it starts with one word, ends with another word. This is also a military campaign, right? The style of a military campaign. We have an example of a military campaign with a similar style in Joshua, which sort of bolsters G.I. Davis's claim that this was a military list. Which is outlining a military campaign, and that's why it was written that.
You think GR means military?
So what does
that
mean?
It's ancient Near East. So it is.
Writing this portion in the Bible.
18th century BC. Yeah, I think that's their claim. More or less, it would have a similar literary structure.
And it's countering the idea that it was a hodgepodge put together.
Right. That's why the article is called The Integrity of the Wilderness Itinerary. It's suggesting there is integrity in this list. It's one list written by one person, and it makes sense that it was written this way. It makes sense because, again, there was water, there was no water, which is something you would write in a military campaign. If you read military campaigns from various wars, the army died there because there was no water. And that's exactly what you have until God came along. So if you read our list, some of the details are there. There was no water. There was water. We crossed water. We crossed the waterway. So it has some of the similar elements, both in style and in content, of an ancient Near East military campaign. So yes, that's his point. Yeah. What's really fascinating about this is that unless you are willing to study archaeological material, you would never have come up with this. Right, but your willingness to look at archaeological material and see if it could help us understand the Torah, right, is a very interesting and important, because we have lots of different options. Maybe the Rambam's approach talks to you. Maybe Rashi's approach talks to you. But maybe this is another way, from a literary perspective, to try to make sense of an otherwise very difficult. And now we know, by the way, now this is the best answer as to why it's listed again. All the places that listed, because that was an account of the events when it happened. But now I'm recapitulating the military campaign from Egypt to Eretz Israel. So I'm giving you a whole list. Just we're about to get on to the next stage of the campaign. Okay, everyone, that's it for today.
Thank you.
That was a long war.